Hello and welcome to the PSPA podcast. I'm Megan Hodgson, PSPA's research coordinator, and I'm hosting this episode of the podcast because of its focus on research. We know research is a topic our supporters are keen to learn more about, how it's helping us diagnose people earlier, how it's looking to find new treatments for the symptoms and treatments to slow progression. To shine a light on the PSP and CBD research landscape, today I'll be talking to Dr. Ed Jabari from UCL in London. Welcome, Ed. Could you just introduce yourself and your current role at Queen Square in London for us?
Hey, hi, Megan. Thanks very much for having me. So I'm Ed Jabari. I'm currently working as a neurology trainee at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery. And I'm also a clinical researcher at the UCL Queen Square Institute of Neurology. And my research focuses on PSP and other Parkinsonian disorders.
Sounds super busy.
Yeah, keeps me busy.
You've been working with PSPA for a few years now. Could you give us a bit of an overview of the research you've been involved with over the years?
Yeah, so the PSPA have been a massive part of my career. So when I first started in PSP research, this was back in 2016. I obtained the Sarah Coe PSPA Fellowship. And this enabled me to start working with Hugh Morris at UCL. And that position subsequently allowed me to obtain kind of my own funding from the UK Medical Research Council to continue my research on PSP. And the main focus during my PhD in that time between 2016 and 2020 was improving our understanding of how PSP can present clinically. So for many years, we thought of PSP as just being one disease that looked the same. So the classic form of PSP is where patients will have very early falls, they'll have problems with their eye movements and problems with their speech and their swallowing. But what our work on the UK-wide prospect study showed was that there's a wide spectrum of ways that patients can present. Some of them can look a lot more like frontotemporal dementia. They can have very profound cognitive abnormalities very early on, and some can look very much like Parkinson's disease early on in the disease course, and that can be very difficult to distinguish from true Parkinson's disease. So I guess the main impact of that work was shedding a light on those various forms of PSP that will, we hope, go towards improving the diagnosis and the awareness for other clinicians in terms of how it can present. So that was one aspect of the PhD work. And then the other aspect was, well, we know now that PSP can present in different forms. And the other interesting observation is that those different forms of PSP can progress at different rates. Some of them progress quickly, some of them progress slowly. So the big question is, why is that the case? Are there biological reasons as to why patients look different and why they progress at different rates? So what we did was we leveraged the power of genetics to look into those reasons why those differences occur in PSP. And the main findings from those various research those various genetic studies that we did was we discovered two particular genes that are involved in those different forms of PSP, and one of those genes being TRIM11, and this is a gene that's related to the ubiquitin proteasome system. So this is essentially the cell's waste disposal system, how we get rid of unwanted proteins in our cells. And this system has been implicated in a number of different neurodegenerative diseases. And this was the first time we had a link with PSP and this particular system. And then the other genetic study that we did found that another gene called LARC2 was associated with how quickly or slowly your disease progressed. And this was a really interesting finding because LARC2 is a gene that's been associated with Parkinson's disease. It's a very well-established link with Parkinson's. And here we found a link with PSP and the speed at which it progresses. And the upshot of all of this is that the real impact of this work is that currently, right now, both groups at UCL and wider groups across the world are now working on these two particular biological targets, the TRIM11 target and the LRRK2 target, to see whether these are potential new therapeutic avenues where if we target those pathways and those genes with drugs, can we potentially stop or slow down the progression of the disease? So that was the main kind of summary of the work that I did during my PhD between 2016 and 2020.
What will be the impact of this research for people in the next couple of years?
Yeah, so I guess in summary, what I'm trying to say in terms of the impact is the first aspect in terms of widening our understanding of how the disease can present. Will go towards improving early diagnosis of the condition and just generally raising awareness of the different ways that the condition can present to non-specialists. Because obviously, we have to remember that the way PSP patients initially present is not to a movement disorder specialist in a tertiary center. It's usually to their GP, to falls clinics, to memory clinics, etc. It's raising awareness in those settings that's really important. And then the other aspect in terms of the genetic studies, the real impact for patients is opening up the potential for new treatment targets, which is something that we desperately need in the world of PSP, because we know that unfortunately we don't at the moment have any effective medications that can stop or slow down the disease in its tracks.
Last year, you applied for a research grant to progress research, hoping to establish a biomarker for PSP. Can you tell us a little bit about that research?
Yeah, so I mean, we've just been talking about how raising awareness of the different ways that the disease can present, and obviously the way we detect those different forms of the condition is through a clinical assessment. It's a neurologist examining a patient, picking up certain signs on examination. But what we know from various cohort studies, longitudinal cohort studies of PSP patients, including those in the UK-wide Prospect study, is that relying on a clinical assessment alone, even in expert hands, does unfortunately lead to misdiagnosis of patients and delays in diagnosis for patients. Now, you may ask the question, well, if we don't have an effective treatment for the condition, why does that matter? Why does diagnosing, having an early and accurate diagnosis, really matter for patients? Why don't we just bide our time and wait, and only when the signs become really, really obvious do we then tell someone we think you've got PSP? Well, that's one argument. That's one way of looking at things. But we've really done our research on this. We've not only spoken to patients, the hundreds of patients that we've seen in clinic, but also we've done surveys through speaking to the PSPA's PPIE group, and we know that patients don't like being kept in the dark. They don't like this diagnostic uncertainty. If they had the opportunity to know as early as possible, they find that empowering. They want to know that information. So that's one reason why achieving an early and accurate diagnosis is so important. The other reason why it's important is we know from other neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's disease, that potentially the earlier we treat these conditions, earlier in the disease course, then that theoretically the more likely we are to achieve have an effective impact on slowing down the rate of progression in the condition. So I mean, and one, to give you an example, the latest tau antibody trials in PSP patients that we were involved with at UCL and other sites in the UK, the average disease duration for patients that were recruited to those trials was around 3.5 years. And if you think about PSP being a fairly fast progressing condition, certainly in comparison to Parkinson's disease, having a patient in a clinical trial when they've had had their symptoms for 3.5, 4 years, they're already in the advanced stages of the disease. So it's less likely, even if the drug was truly effective, it's less likely to have an impact on the disease course. So that's another reason why we think it's really important to have an early and accurate diagnosis. Now, in terms of how we're going to do that, we've been very encouraged by what we've seen in the Parkinson's disease world, where they've developed, well, a number of different research groups have been working on the development of alpha-synuclein seed amplification assays. So in a nutshell, what these tests do is they are detecting the presence of these abnormal misfolded proteins that that characterize these various neurodegenerative conditions. So in the case of Parkinson's disease, it's this protein called alpha-synuclein. In the case of PSP, it's 4-repeat tau protein. And all of us have these proteins in our brain, but in the case of Parkinson's disease, and in PSP and other neurodegenerative conditions, these proteins become more sticky and they clump together. And when they do this, they then eventually lead to a wearing down of brain cells that then lead to the manifestations, the symptoms of these conditions and the progression of these conditions. So what we're doing in these tests is we are taking patient fluid samples, whether it be blood or spinal fluid, and these samples will contain those abnormal misfolded proteins. We're then adding those to a recombinant, a man-made form of that protein of interest, and we're mixing them together. And then what happens in the reaction is that that abnormal protein that's present in your patient's sample will cause that man-made protein to then become sticky and clump together. And you can actually measure that clumping together, which we refer to as aggregation, via measuring fluorescence when we add a fluorescent dye. So that's been a bit of a game changer for how we diagnose Parkinson's disease. And what we wanted to do was to apply the same techniques to see whether we could develop a 4-repeat tau seed amplification assay to aid in the diagnosis of PSP and CBD.
So when will this study finish, and how will you know if it's been successful? How are you measuring that?
Yeah, so we've made very good progress in a short space of time. So thanks to the funding from the PSP Association, I was able to travel to the US in February and March of this year to work in one of the world leading laboratories in the US who are experts in the development of these seed amplification assays. And already we've had some really promising results from that trip. So what we've found is that when we apply our PSP patient samples, and these were patients that were in the PROSPECT study, when we apply their spinal fluid samples to both their established alpha-synuclein seed amplification assay that they've already got developed at that laboratory, and also on the 4-repeat tau assay that we managed to develop in that short space of time, we find that the combination of testing a patient sample on both of those assays is leads to a very reliable differentiation between Parkinson's disease and PSP samples. So that's a really promising start. We've not quite got there in terms of finalizing all of our experiments, but the aim is to have all of this work wrapped up by the end of this calendar year.
It's really, really exciting research. Really, we're really looking forward to seeing kind of what comes out of it. You did mention CBD. Would this be the same technique to test for CBD, or would it be a different kind of test?
Yeah, so the concept behind what we're doing would be applicable to CBD as well, of course, because CBD, like PSP, that they're both these 4-repeat tauopathies, so they're caused by the buildup of this abnormal misfolded 4-repeat tau protein. The tests that we're developing should be able to pick up the same abnormal misfolded proteins in the patient samples that we're detecting in PSP patients. For now, the focus is going to be on our PSP patient samples, and the only reason for that is because we've got more PSP samples than CBD samples. But the view is very much once we've obtained, further funding sources to test this on a much wider, larger cohort of both PSP and CBS samples from patients who have corticobasal syndrome.
And what would your next steps be in this research? You said that you're using spinal fluid samples. Is there scope to use this in, say, a blood test or skin biopsy?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So there's been some really promising work from our international colleagues, in particular in Canada, where they've developed skin versions of these seed amplification assays. It's obviously very preliminary work on very small numbers of patient samples, but it's promising nonetheless because we've not had this before. So to have these tests in development, I think is very exciting. In terms of my own work, as I mentioned in the previous question, this project that's been funded by the PSP Association should be coming to an end at the end of this calendar year. And what I'm going to be doing is using the preliminary data that we've gathered in this project to use it for applications for wider, larger funding sources to really take these studies to the next level. Which is looking in much larger cohorts and not only looking to see whether these tests are going to be helpful from a diagnosis perspective, but also whether they can be helpful for prognosis in terms of whether they can predict how quickly or slowly a patient will progress, and therefore whether we might also be able to use these tests in clinical trials and future clinical trials for our PSP and CBD patients.
Really interested in hearing about your projects. What are your hopes for PSP and CBD research in the future, kind of globally?
So globally, I think what we've got at the moment is a really good international collaborative network of PSP and CBD researchers. And I think that's exactly what leads to really well-powered studies of really deeply phenotyped and characterized patients with these conditions. And that is the backbone of these studies. We're spending a lot of time talking about techniques where we're looking at patient samples, but what remains at the heart of all of this is accurate and thorough clinical assessments of patients. And that's what we've got through our wide collaborative network of international researchers. In terms of where I see the research priorities, I think the two biggest unmet needs for our patients is, as I mentioned, to have a diagnostic test that will help us in the diagnosis of patients. And what I do want to stress again is that I'm not talking about a test replacing a neurologist. I think it's really important that patients have contact with a neurologist regularly, and just being listened to and assessed by a neurologist is really important. This test is not going to replace that. It's just going to aid a neurologist in those really tricky cases, particularly earlier on in the disease course, where we're really not sure whether a patient's going to have PSP or whether they have Parkinson's disease. And that's why so many of our patients end up being misdiagnosed. So I think that's one big research priority. And then the second one, which is the glaringly obvious unmet need, is that we don't have effective treatments for these conditions. So the more research that we do in trying to identify promising treatment targets, I think that's a really big research priority for these conditions.
Thank you, Ed. It's been really great speaking to you today. Hopefully, this discussion has helped our listeners better understand how far research has come in recent years and the progress that continues. If you'd like to learn more about current research into PSP and CBD, you can watch back footage from our online research information session on our website. PSPA is committed to working with people affected by PSP and CPD and researchers to create a better future. If you'd like to express an interest in our research to learn more about the most up-to-date studies you can take part in, please email research@pspassociation.org.uk.